CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Ink Stud Show, the show where we talk about comics. And let's see, it's 2-something. And that was Lungfish, Love is Love. And I am joined by Mr. Anders Nilsson. I got you there, Anders?
Yeah.
Did I pronounce your name right?
It's Anders Nilsson.
Anders. Okay. I apologize profusely.
Right.
I'm notoriously for mispronouncing things in this show. I usually get yelled at by people. So, now you're the creator of, I've got a stack of stuff in front of me. I've got the new book, Monologues for the Coming Plague, from Fantagraphics. Big Questions, 7 and 8. Unfortunately, I can't track down 1 through 6. I guess they've disappeared into the nether region of out-of-print books.
I actually just reprinted a bunch of the early issues.
Oh, wow.
Kind of a small run of just kind of photocopied versions of them.
Well, were they originally, because you had you won a Zurich grant, were they originally part of that Zurich grant?
I won the Zurich grant for The Ballad of the Two-Headed Boy.
Okay.
Which is almost unrecognizable as my work, some people say. it's pretty different. It's more of like a picture book than a comic. But I did get some small grants from the City of Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs to do number 4, 5, and 6 of Big Question.
Wow. I wish Vancouver would give grants for comics. That rocks. So let's start out with kind of the old biographical information of how you got into comics, and, you know, now you have your BFA or is it your MFA?
I have a BFA, and I did do a year of graduate work in Chicago at the Art Institute, but I did a year and then quit.
I was reading the latest MOM that came out yesterday, and you have one of your papers. I guess that was from grad course. So we'll get maybe into that a little bit later. But first, kind of what got you into comics? You know, because your stuff is very different from most traditional comics, so I don't really see a lot of reading X-Men as a kid in this.
I did actually read a lot of X-Men as a kid. I guess the first comics that I read were probably Tintin. I don't know if people are familiar with Tintin's Belgian...
Very familiar in Canada. Good chunk of the country speaks French. I don't, but
right.
A lot of people do.
So that was a huge influence when I was really young, and I still really revere Hergé. I still think of him as kind of the quintessential master in a lot of ways. But I was into superhero comics as a kid too, a lot of the X-Men, various X-Men titles and stuff. And then I guess, I don't know exactly what happened, but I sort of got interested in like punk music and then along with that, things like Raw and Weirdo and zines and mini comics. And I think as I got older, I just sort of became more interested in things that were a little bit more on the fringe, a little more unusual.
I can understand that.
Yeah.
We're probably about the same, around the same age. You're 27?
I'm actually 32.
32? Oh, okay. I thought you were younger. Well, I'm about 28, so we're, you know, rough areas of, say,
right,
comic, getting into it, you know, start out with, you know, a little bit of the superhero, and then somehow latched onto a copy of Velvet Glove, and
right,
it all went downhill from there. So, when you, what was it a trigger for you that really wanted to do comics?
I don't know. I mean, I guess in high school I did do comics a little bit. Just, you know, for myself. I actually had a teacher that let me do some writing assignments as comics. But then I went to school in New Mexico and studied painting and did a lot of, like, installation art, and sort of left comics behind, although I did start working on this Ballad of the Two-Headed Boy thing, and I did a zine when I was in college and stuff. And I don't know, I think that, I mean, definitely during college I kind of decided I was going to be, you know, like a fine artist, and mostly left comics behind, and I think it was basically when I finished school and all of a sudden you don't have that structure of, you know, you have teachers and other students that are there to look at your work and talk about it. You're sort of cast adrift in the real world. And comics just made more sense all of a sudden. Like, I could do a little photocopied mini comic and send it to my friends, and I kind of, it had a built-in audience, and it was actually more, it was just more fun. Like, it just,
you're getting more immediateness out of it than kind of a long, drawn-out art project.
Right.
So
yeah, right. And the whole thing had a context of its own. It's like I could show it to anybody, and they could kind of get it. You know, and I could show it to somebody at work, and like, they'd laugh. Whereas if I did a painting, you know, maybe I'd have somebody over to see it, but that doesn't really feel that rewarding. It's like you got to get it into a gallery or a museum somewhere, and like, that's just sort of alien to my life. I mean, you know, there are ways of sort of going about that, and I've kept up with that kind of stuff a little bit, but it's just, it feels more mysterious if you don't, you know, if you don't have some connection.
Well, comics is a neat medium because it's very, I find it's very personal, like very directly personal, especially with a lot of your work, the more monologue-esque stuff. It seems like you're doing like a direct dialogue
right
to your readership.
Yeah, right.
So kind of like with painting, you're kind of like, here's one thing, and kind of try and get a lot out of it. But with comics, you can express more, and you're telling a story.
Right.
Now, you're talking earlier about like being pushed by, when you were in school, by other students and professors and stuff. Now, you're part of the Holy Consumption Collective. Now, does that kind of help towards right now with your own comics work, with the other members pushing you, and you push each other in your work?
Yeah, I would say in some ways. I don't feel a lot more connected to them than I do to other friends, like people like Kevin Huizenga and Sammy Harkham, who also, you know, they're people that I met through doing comics early on, and we were all sort of in the same spot. And I think like Jeffrey Brown and Paul Hornschmeyer, who are part of the Holy Consumption, are definitely part of that group. I mean, I feel like there was this, is or was this sort of group of people of sort of the same generation that all,
mm-hmm,
I feel like, yeah, we're definitely all kind of
on the same wavelength, but it's
on the same wavelength and pushing each other and like looking at each other's work. And
and you're all completely different too, like all the art styles, like Sammy Harkham,
yeah,
Kevin Huizenga,
Huizenga.
All of you are completely different, and it's neat. That's a neat idea that it is pushing each other, because it's good to kind of avoid that, I don't know, that stale of doing work in a vacuum. I think
right,
this can happen.
Right.
So, big questions we have. So, which ones will be available, say, if someone came to a con to see you? Because I'm going to go to SPX and be dropping my own stuff.
I just reprinted number 3, 4, and 5. The main story starts in number 3.
Okay.
And I'm going to do a small reprint of number 6 as well. I actually have a bunch of the original color covers that I can use for that. That one's a little bit more complicated because it has a a big fold-out spread in the middle.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, I'm going to try to actually have that stuff for SPX. But 3, 4, and 5, I've sent boxes to a bunch of different stores. So it should be available. I don't know. You know, I maybe sent them out to like 15 or 20 stores.
Well, I know that Lucky's in Vancouver. Gabe there says he's been emailing you, and he sold mass quantities of the 7 and 8. So I hope that's in one of the stores.
Yeah. I haven't heard from them, but...
I'll ask them.
Yeah.
Now, big questions. The story, like, you're anthropomorphizing. Is that a good way to say, or are you just creating identities for the characters in it? Like, is it based on people you know and kind of certain characteristics, or is it, I don't know, certain identities in nature?
I think of all those characters, both the birds and the people, I think of them all as being like kind of being parts of me, like different sides of my personality in a way. But then there are, but also as types in the world, you know, types of people and types of like ways of different ways of approaching, circumstance or, problems or just, you know, the way the world is. The names of the birds, actually, a lot of the, especially at first, I was naming the birds after the people in my family of my grandparents' generation. So a lot of the names are like my great aunts and great uncles and stuff.
Well, that's actually pretty neat as a way of like kind of continuing storytelling.
Yeah.
Kind of, because, you know, family things are kind of fall to the wayside. A lot of people kind of forget that kind of stuff, but it's neat to kind of keep touch with your roots.
Right.
I like that aspect. Now, Dog in Water, is that your latest of that kind of series? Like, that and Monologues Come Play, I guess, your two most recent books.
Yeah, well, Big Questions 7 and 8 came out after Dogs in Water.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, Dogs in Water came out at the very beginning of 2005, I guess.
Now, I'm interested in Dogs in Water because it was something you'd originally been working on, and you had the part of it in Mome. Now, when you started that, was the intention to do the story as is in Dogs in Water, or was it something different?
The piece that appeared in Mome is actually something I did in, like, 1997 or 1998, maybe. And kind of came, I mean, actually sort of connects into what I was talking about with school and leaving school and, the sort of feeling of, I don't know, graduating with this art degree that all of a sudden seemed rather useless and sort of, absurd a little bit. And so it has, you know, it has this character sort of like stranded out in the middle of nowhere, and he's got this bear on his back that seems to have given him advice or told him to go out there, and then now the bear's not talking to him, and he's sort of stranded, and that's kind of how I felt in a certain way.
It's kind of that anticlimactic end to art school.
Yeah, and it's like this childhood idea, you know, ever since I can remember, I had this idea in my head that I was going to be like an artist, and then all of a sudden I'm sort of out in the real world, and I followed this idea all the way out, and like, what does it mean? Like, it doesn't really mean much. I don't know.
One thing,
And I just kind of sat on that. It was just, you know, a couple of page long sort of weird little experimental story in my sketchbook. And I sat on that for a while, and then after I'd done a few issues of Big Questions, Chris Oliveros at Drawn and Quarterly saw them, I guess, and I'd sent them to him, and I met him at a show in San Francisco. And he kind of just emailed me out of the blue one day and asked me to do a story for the showcase, which was going to be, which at that time was going to be a new anthology of kind of new artists. And for some reason, I decided that I would go back to this little piece and elaborate on it. It seemed like it had a lot of potential, but then once I started working on it, in the end, it sort of did. But it was actually quite a struggle to get that story, that little bit, to turn into a larger story.
One thing I find really interesting with the MOM one is that the collaboration part is the photographs really add to the bleakness.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really neat aspect, is really bringing it to another dimension.
Right.
It's like that mixed media, which is, I really like seeing in comics, because I think like there's so much potential that can really like follow through, and it's a different kind of level of storytelling, because it adds that aspect of just kind of more to interpret, I guess.
Right. It's another layer of sort of commentary on the situation that's being depicted. It's funny, actually. I think of that piece that was in MOM as being the prototype for Dogs in Water, but in a funny way, it actually is a prototype for the first story I did in MOM, which is the big landscape photographs that have the comics kind of superimposed on top.
Now, actually, I'm going to take a quick music break, and then I really want to get into the that style, because I think it's a really interesting technique of storytelling. I was going to play next. I think I had my notes of music. I was going to play Plan B. Does that sound good?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay, and we'll be back in a sec. CITR 101.9. I'm speaking with Anders. Did I pronounce it right?
Yep.
Anders Nilsson. And this is Plan B by, who was it again? The New Year.
The New Year.
Okay.
Separated, I'll never realize.
CITR 101.9 FM. That was Plan B by The New Year off the album The End Is Near. And I'm speaking with Anders Nilsson, and we're talking about comics and all sorts of great comics that you have. I'm enjoying them. So I want to get into the first MoMA anthology. We're about to start getting into the is it, I guess, a collage piece?
Yeah, it's all kind of done in the computer. There's no, actual piece, you know, giant photograph with drawings on it.
Okay. It's a pretty original kind of format. And I think it's really interesting because it's such a neat, seems like an internal dialogue struggle.
Right.
In these stories, is that kind of, am I getting the right idea from it?
Yeah. Yeah, what is that story? I don't know. It's
The Beast.
Right.
The guy's locked up, handcuffed, and then gets vacuumed.
I don't know. I've been doing these sort of, there's kind of, at least to start with, they're very sort of stream of consciousness, and I just, the idea is just to start writing, doing the writing and the drawing and not really plan it out at all. And just sort of see where it goes, and so I don't really have a good answer for like who that character is or what is going on. That kind of like is he, like he's kind of crazy, but he's kind of hallucinating. But then the things that he talks about end up kind of being true or bearing out in some way. And I guess one of the themes in that piece, which is also a theme in Dogs and Water, is the whole idea of sort of living your life in your little world, and you know, actually kind of being an artist, and then also what does it mean to be an artist, and when there's all this sort of craziness in the world, and violence and war and whatever, and you know, here I am sort of sitting in my studio drawing.
It's kind of like an ideological struggle.
Yeah, a little bit.
Well, that's something, there's kind of different themes I see running throughout all the, would it be the monologue series, would that be a good way of putting it?
Yeah, I think that's kind of how I think about it. I think that's a good way of...
And it's funny because the book The Monologues for Come and Play came out, and I did a review of Moam for our local paper here. And I called it a monologue, and you know, monologue style. And then the book's called The Monologue, so I think I'm on the right track.
Yeah, my plan is to do two more of those books. I have a lot of material.
And that's done right in your sketchbook, right?
Yeah, it's all done pretty much straight. I mean, I do edit a lot of stuff out. There ends up being a bunch of stuff that doesn't really make any sense or work or whatever, but mostly it comes straight from my sketchbook.
So. What kind of roles religion play for you? Because that's something I see. It's like an ongoing theme in the monologues.
Mm-hmm. What role does religion play for me? I don't know. I grew up not particularly religious, although my mother's father and her brother are both Lutheran ministers. She goes to church. I went to church a little bit when I was a kid. But I'm personally basically an atheist, but I'm really interested in religion, in particular in the ways that people make meaning out of things, out of the world, or out of, you know, stories, the stories of, you know, the Bible or whatever. And how people interpret their lives or the events that happen to them, or stories, and how everybody kind of interprets them differently, but some people assume that it's nevertheless perfectly true. I don't know. It's just kind of a fascinating subject to me.
Well, that really...
I think there's a thing with being a storyteller myself. I have a certain kind of jealousy of something like the Bible, which is a story that people absolutely believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, it's like the ultimate goal for me is to create something that's so powerful that, you know,
it's got its own set of beliefs.
Believe in it. But of course, it's kind of an unattainable goal. It's already been done by.
Well, that's really rings true in your latest piece in Moam. Not the art history one, but the other one. I think it was the guy walks down the street and kills Buddha or something.
Oh, right, right.
I kind of read it really quick last night because I just got it yesterday.
Yeah.
Available out on stands now. Where was I going with that?
I don't know, religion.
Religion. Well, it's interesting because it in the States, I think it has a far bigger role in society than it does up here. It's not something that like I'm necessarily exposed to constantly.
Right.
Like our political figureheads don't really care about religion too much. I mean, right now Stephen Harper's a little different, but I mean, you know, the last prime minister we had, you know, was I don't even know how religious he really was, and so it's neat. It's a definitely different dynamic.
Yeah.
And I think, like, is that something that's continuously, I don't know if, like, you're in Chicago, so I don't know if that's something that's necessarily as vocal as the southern states, but is that something that does kind of continually permeate into the constant discussion and whatnot?
Yeah, it's more and more. It's something that unfortunately seems to be, you know, people's idea about absolute truth and the fact that they have it seems to be all over the place. And I guess it does, like, it sort of filters into my work in certain ways. It's not something that I deal with explicitly for sure, but.
Well, that's something I wonder is, like, do you feel that as an artist with religion just creating, you know, so much, I don't know, hysteria, as you say, like people believe in an absolute truth, and here you are telling a story, utilizing religious, I'm not gonna say icons, but I guess it's kind of icons, but not visual icons, but verbal icons. Do you feel like that, I don't know, like luckily you're in underground comics or alternative comics where it doesn't really get affected, but do you kind of see that like there is potential there, or am I just like blabbing out of my butt?
Potential for?
For just like, you know, an influence on comics itself with increasing religious, I don't know, hysteria and stuff. Like, do people kind of self-censor themselves? Just to kind of, I don't want to like ruffle any feathers.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I don't think I don't think that anybody that I really know or work that I'm aware of is actually careful of it because of sort of larger societal concerns. You know, I mean, I think some people might be careful of it because of their families or something. And there is the piece that I did. I think it was in Monologues. But it first appeared in Kramer's Ergot number 4, which says some sort of things about Jesus and Mary and God and Joseph, and kind of says kind of blasphemous things that to me are just sort of funny and like interesting ways of playing with their stories, with those stories. But there are people in my life that if they saw that might be offended and might you know, might not know how to address it with me. Which is a weird, you know, it's a weird thing. But it's not something that I'm gonna shy away from because of that.
No, and damn rights don't. Why the choice to do the simplistic art style for the monologues?
I started doing that kind of thing when after I'd been working on Dogs and Water and Big Questions pretty exclusively for a couple of years. When previous to that, I'd always really done a lot of different kinds of work, and was kind of all over the place. And then all of a sudden I was really locked into this style, which is, you know, at times it's pretty spare, but it's pretty, things are pretty carefully rendered, and I really want them to look a certain way, and they tend to be, in a lot of cases, fairly labor-intensive. So I wasn't really doing much work in my sketchbooks for a long time because of that. And at a certain point, I just kind of felt like I was going a little stir-crazy, and I needed to do some stuff that was just totally fast and not planned out. And it kind of, it coincided with the, when Kramer Zergot number 4 came out, a bunch of people in the book did a little book signing tour. So I was in a van with a bunch of other cartoonists for like a week or a little over a week. It was really sort of refreshing because everybody was always drawing all the time, like in their sketchbooks, just like stuff that they
were just sitting there and just doing it.
Yeah. And I think it was kind of right after that tour, actually, that I cracked open this new sketchbook, and just a lot of the stuff in monologues just sort of poured right out.
Well, it's really interesting, like being able to just tell a story without having to go through, because the one neat thing is you're such a detailed renderer with the big number or the big questions and the dogs and water, and also I think Kramer got 4, the one with the Sisyphus,
right?
And also the Minotaur story, which are all like beautifully, like detailedly rendered.
Right.
Within Kramer's Ergot 4, which I'll continue promoting because it's a fabulous book. Do they kind of play the role as like beginning and closers for the book? Was that kind of an intention?
They do, yeah.
And it's kind of like an opener and shadow. It's a pretty neat book. How did you get involved with Kramer's Ergot? Because you're involved in number 3. I don't have 1 and 2 because, well, I think they're impossible to find now.
Yeah, I think you can get them from the Avoda website.
Oh, really? Okay.
I believe so. I think he still has some issues left. And there are some interesting things in them. They're not nearly as sort of brimming over as the other ones.
Well, when you do stuff for Kramer's and for Moam, are you doing like something... Is there something you're trying to do for that works with that type of anthology, and then for Moam for like a different type of anthology? Or do you just kind of approach it the same way as just your work?
I kind of just approach it as my work. I mean, I do have this sort of idea that, I don't know, I mean, Moam sort of came along at a point when I already had Drawn in Quarterly as a publisher, but Moam came along and it was kind of a place that I could put stuff that I couldn't put anywhere else. You know, stuff that was full color, stuff that was just sort of experimental. I mean, I felt like for some reason Moam just, it doesn't feel precious to me. It feels like a place to just, you know, kind of do whatever. I mean, not that I'm, you know, gonna put crappy work in there or something, but like, so in that sense, it is, I do feel differently about Moam. I feel like, yeah, it's just a place I can kind of experiment.
But you're not in the latest Kramer's Ergot book.
Right, no, I'm not in number 6. I just had too much other stuff going on at that point. And I feel with Kramer's, I don't know, I have these weird divisions in my head. I mean, now I feel like, and I don't know that this will continue this way, but I feel like with Fantagraphics I think of as kind of my publisher for the more monologue-ish sort of work. And Drawn in Quarterly and sort of Kramer's, I want to do the kind of more finished work for them.
The more tight rendered stuff.
Yeah.
What kind of work do we have to look forward from you?
I have a bunch of stuff coming out in the next few months. Big Questions 9 will be out in October, which is like 48 pages. I think it's pretty substantial.
Wow.
And then there'll be two more issues of that, but they won't be out probably until early spring, maybe.
Now, so there is a definite end for that story?
Yeah, there is.
Did you have that in mind from the beginning? Like, basically rough structure?
Yeah, basically. I mean, I had a lot of the main plot points sort of from, you know, number 3 or 4. And it's just been a process of sort of getting to those plot points, and the process of getting from one to the other gets longer and longer, and more plot points develop in between. And but yeah, it's coming to a close. But then also in October, there's a book, Drawn and Quarterly is doing a book called Don't Go Where I Can't Follow, which is about basically it's kind of a documentation of my relationship with my girlfriend. She was also my fiance, who she passed away last November from Hodgkin's lymphoma cancer. And that book it's some comics. I think there's maybe 20 pages of comics, and about 60 pages of other stuff. There's some kind of photo journal stuff. There's some writing. A lot of it is stories of us traveling. And then the end of the book is kind of has a little bit about her illness. And there's some sketchbook, like sort of diary journal stuff in there of mine, and then also some drawings I did of her, like in the hospital.
Was that a challenge putting that book together?
It was a challenge. It was also, after she died, it was kind of the only thing I could really do. Like, I couldn't work on anything else for a while. So it was a challenge, but it was also very necessary and probably helpful, cathartic, kind of, also.
A remembrance.
Yeah, yeah, right. And then I actually just finished another book that Fantagraphics is going to do that probably won't be out until January or something. Which is called The End, Number One, and that is also kind of dealing with the aftermath of Cheryl's death, and it's not so much about her illness or her death, but it's kind of about my life since she died, sort of the aftermath of, you know, my life in the aftermath.
Well, it sounds pretty powerful, revealing stuff. Must have been a lot of challenge putting that together.
Yeah, it's a peculiar thing to... I mean, most of my work really is not autobiographical, and I sort of tend to shy away from that, actually. But it's kind of like... It's just what's on my mind right now, and I'm doing that work in my sketchbooks, and I'm doing, you know, I'm just kind of thinking about it all the time, so it's sort of just necessary, and what I hope is that there's really something there for a reader, that it's, you know, the kind of autobiography that I especially don't like is the...
Navel-gazing?
Yeah, the navel-gazing, or else the, like, car crash on the highway that you just can't pull your eyes away from, you know? Like, you're watching somebody's bad relationship, and it's fascinating, but kind of disgusting, or whatever. and I'm trying hard not to engage in that. Like, I really want to try to figure out, like, try to pull some kind of light out of what I've gone through and what I've experienced, and have something that's worth sharing, you know, with an audience.
Well, I think that's it's kind of like the original role of autobiocomics, like avoiding like the navel gazing, the Joe right. Matt 5 issues of him and his porn collection, is being able to tell your own story, to tell a story, and sometimes I think that can be lost. And a lot of, like, one big thing is a lot of people are like, shock, or it's like, look how crazy I am, and look at what I get up to. But I think that's interesting. It's just being able to tell something straight from the heart.
Yeah.
So I really look forward to that. I think I'm gonna finish up with one of your songs, one of your other picks. What I wasn't able to track down The Bitter Tears.
Okay.
I tried hard, even the station. So I have.
Yeah, no, that doesn't surprise me that much. It's a local Chicago band that's pretty small scale. It's actually a friend of mine who's. If anybody out there is able to track down The Bitter Tears, they should, because they're really awesome.
And check it. We'll get the station to track it down sometime. So I have a choice between the X, Elizabeth Cotton, and the Lavender Diamond.
Oh, let's see. I don't know. It was hard enough to try to narrow down to four to start with. I guess let's go with the X.
Okay.
I just saw them play. I saw the New Year and them play at the Touch and Go Records anniversary party this weekend, and they were both really totally amazing. I'd never actually seen the X before or heard their music, and they pretty much played one of the best shows I've ever seen. So.
Nice. I look forward to listening to. I haven't listened to them before, but I couldn't even find it online. But we had it at the station. I think we have everything by Touch and Go here. So.
Cool.
Thanks for coming on, Anders.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, mispronouncing. I look forward to meeting you at SPX and getting some more big questions. And we'll have this online soon.
Well, thank you for having me.
Excellent. Have a good day.
All right, you too.
Bye. Bye. CITR 101.9 on the FM dial, yo. What up, dogs? This is Ink Studs, the radio show about comics. We were just yakking a couple minutes ago with Anders Nilsson. That was the X off the album Dizzy Spells, and the song was Heydays. So I'm spending the next couple of minutes just doing some announcements, telling you about some good books I've read that you need to check out. And if you don't, what's your problem? From Fantagraphics, just came out yesterday. We're talking about the Mome anthology. The latest one just came out with a couple of great stories by Anders Nilsson. Gabriel Bell's in it. She's always excellent. She's Jeffrey Brown. We yacked with him a while ago. His stuff is excellent. Jonathan Bennett, excellent. Sophie Crumb, excellent. Okay, everything in this book is good. If you don't buy it, what the hell's your problem? Three new books in the Ignat series, coordinated by Igort, Baobab, Niger, and Reflections. They're all the Ignat series stuff is great books. I really recommend checking it out, all of it. Next Sunday, Word Under the Street at the main library. They have Word on the Street, you know, around the library, you go everywhere, you know, look at books, yada yada. If you want to see the good stuff, go to Word Under the Street, which is downstairs in some room where all the comic guys will be, including some guy named Joe Sacco. Joe Sacco is an internationally renowned, incredible talent who does kind of like comics journalism. His latest book, But I Don't Like It, I think it's called. I can't remember. It's good. He's Palestine and Safe Area Garajde. I can't even pronounce it properly. Both great political. He goes, travels to Palestine and sits with people, interviews them, and talks about their struggles that they're going through. But I Like It. That's the name of his newest book. Notes from a Fetus from Fantagraphics, Safe Area Garajde, Palestine. All those books are awesome. Palestine really is a great breakthrough book. I don't think he'll ever be able to make a book like that again, simply because of this was done way long ago before a lot of shit hit the fan. Excuse me for swearing, but it's pretty much true. The Middle East is a mess right now. And, you know, I don't know if it would be safe for him to be able to do that book again. So check it out. Palestine, it's excellent. All the stuff's excellent. That's from Fantagraphics. He also has two books from Drawing Quarterly, Wars and The Fixer, both more stuff about Sarajevo. He went there and did a lot of research there. And that, you know, that place is a mess too. It's just incredible, all the challenges that people have gone through. And he really accurately portrays it of what people have gone through. And it's good, like, check it out. Some new stuff for Drawn Quarterly. Drawn Quarterly Showcase number 4. Pick it up. It's excellent. It's got a Gabriel Bell story in it, and her stuff is always good to find. And let's see. The new Yoshiro Tatsumi book is out, A Man in the Old Tokyo. I picked that up last week, read it. Awesome. I'm going to keep saying stuff's awesome, because it's awesome. It's good. If you haven't checked out Maybe Later or Get a Life from Dupuis and Beverian, also from Drawn Quarterly, check those out. Great, really personal stories by two French masters. They're just, wow, so good. Such awesomeness. The new Kramer's Ergot. We're talking about Kramer's Ergot earlier. Number 6 just came out, published by Bueno Ventura Press. Lots of good stuff in it. Past ones have had Kevin Huizenga, I think. Tons of great people. Sammy Harkham. Sammy Harkham is one of those guys where I will buy everything he does because there's so little of it. Very similar to like Jordan Crane, Chester Brown, but he's got his own really just a solid, fluid storytelling manner, and it's his art is continuously developing, and it's really neat, and it's just, I don't know, it's wow. Check it out. Crickets is his one issue of a series that came out from Drawn and Quarterly. I think most comic stores have it. If they don't, boo to them. The comic stores I recommend going to are Lucky's Comics, RX Comics. Both are friends of CITR. If you get a Friends of CITR membership card for like $15 or something, you can get discounts there, like 10%, 20% or something. Something good. Both stores are awesome. Also, the comic shop might have some of the stuff we've talked about. I'm not too sure, because I never really leave the Main Street neighborhood. I am lazy. What else have I gotten? Let's check out. Upcoming Comic-Con on November 5th. This weekend on Saturday night is the Comic Jam at the Jolly Alderman. I don't really much like the Jolly Alderman, but I like the Comic Jam. I'm not going to be able to make it, and I'm sad for that. But I think you should go. I think everyone should go. Go draw comics with some local talented boys and girls. Also, if you haven't gotten a chance, go see the Radar Friends Luggage play down. It's playing today at 5:40 down in Granville Island, part of the Fringe Fest. It's fun. I like it. It's a surreal, silly experience. Check it out. I went on Sunday. It was fun. They said my name in the play. I felt special. And that's about it. Rock and roll, everybody. I'm going to end off with some more of Anders' music picks. I'm going to do Elizabeth Cotton, Shake Sugaree. Yeah, that sounds good. Okay. Inkstead's up next, Crimes and Treasons. And next week, you know, I don't know what we're going to do. Maybe I'm going to try and talk Mark Bellin to come on. Let's hope he'll come on. If not, I have a lot of stuff I need to review, and Don and Colin will be joining me for that. Rock and roll, CITR 101.9 FM.
Well, I have a little song. I'll sing it right if it takes once or twice. Oh, Lord, oh me, then I shake Sugaree. Every time when I say that, I want y'all to say, when I say, oh, Lord, oh me, everybody can say, shake Sugaree. Everything I got is in pawn. My watch, I pawned my chain, I pawned everything that was in my name. Oh Lord, oh me, didn't I shake Sugaree? Everything I got's in, everything I got's in pawn. I pawned my bond, a plow, I pawned everything, I even pawned my old cow. Oh Lord, oh me, didn't I shake Sugaree? Everything I got's in pawn, everything I got's in pawn. I know something I ain't gonna tell. I'm going to heaven in a brown pea shell. Oh Lord, oh me, didn't I shake Sugaree? Everything I got's in pawn. Everything I got's in pawn. I pawn my chair, I pawn my bed, ain't got nowhere to lay my head. Oh Lord, oh me, didn't I shake Sugaree? Everything I got's in pawn. Everything I got's in pawn. I pawn my tobacco, I pawn my pipe, I pawned everything that was in my sight. Oh Lord, oh me, didn't I shake Sugaree? Everything I got's in pawn. Everything I got's in pawn. I have a little secret I ain't gonna tell. I'm going to heaven and I ain't going to. Shake Sugaree, everything I got's in pawn. Everything. chew my tobacco. I spit my juice. I would raise Cain, but it ain't a bit of use. Oh, Lord, oh, me, didn't I shake sugary? Everything I